I'm out on him. I'm in on Zion. You could put Zion at quarterback, and I'd feel more comfortable.
Yeah, I would pay to see Zion at quarterback.
Run Wildcat. Run Wildcat with Zion. See what happens.
Who's tackling that guy?
Nobody.
They'd run. That's what they would do. What's up, guys? Welcome to Birdwatch. I am Christian Clark, the Pelicans beat writer for NOLA.com and the Advocate. Here today with special guest. He covers the Oklahoma City Thunder for The Athletic. Before that, he was the Thunder beat writer for the Oklahoman and all-around good guy, Eric Horn.
That is very flattering, Christian. Thank you very much, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, man. We are. I'm living in your home state now, Louisiana. I mean, I don't really know when you graduated high school or anything, but I mean, were you a Hornets fan growing up? Was that a thing?
No. For people listening that are familiar with New Orleans, I went to Brother Martin High School, and I graduated in 2003. So I think, off the top of my head, I think the Hornets were there at that time, but they had probably just gotten there maybe a few years prior. It hadn't been very long, maybe like 3 or 4 years. So I think people were excited about it, particularly with like the Smoothie King Center being built and all that. And it was like an exciting time, but I was in high school and I already had kind of like my allegiances, so to speak. I wasn't really a fan of any particular team at that time. I grew up rooting for Michael Jordan because those were the games that were on where I was when we were growing up on WGN or nationally. So I was a big Jordan fan. Then he retired, and I guess I kind of liked the Kobe, Shaq Lakers, and I liked that like those Kings teams. But really, like the Hornets really didn't like resonate with me. But I thought it was cool for the city to have the Hornets, and I really appreciated Chris Paul. And you knew something special was going to happen once they got Chris Paul, because the team really took off probably in his like second or third year or so after they, you know, got settled down post Katrina.
I did not know you were a Brother Martin alumni. DJ Augustine's alma mater, right?
I used to watch DJ play in PE. I was maybe a senior, and he was a freshman, and I can't remember if I was a senior or a junior, but he graduated in 06, but he ended up having to graduate from a town in close to Houston. But before he left Brother Martin, he won a couple of state championships, and he appeared in 3 years, which is incredible. But I remember watching him in PE, and I refused to play. I would just watch my classmates get their ass kicked. And I used to just watch him, and I was like, that dude's jumper is, like, so wet. And the rotation on his free throws, I remember just being like, I've never seen the ball come out of a guy's hand like that. And I didn't know he was going to be a pro. I just thought, like, this guy's definitely going to play, you know, college. And I kind of, like, followed his recruiting and stuff like that. He was in the same class as Kevin Durant and those guys in 06. But I just liked watching him play. I never wanted to get out there and have him break my ankles. I was just like, no, I'm just going to watch this dude play. And that's really when, like, basketball at Brother Martin got, like, really popular. A lot of people started going to away games and started attending the games a lot because DJ was this guy that everybody was really proud to root for. And he really got people excited about basketball at Brother Martin. And I think earlier this year he came back and they, like, retired his jersey and all the Magic players were there with him. I got it in like an alumni newsletter recently. So he was just so great for the school. And if Katrina wouldn't have happened, I think they would have ended up winning another state championship with him, but he already won 2 with them. So he did everything he possibly could for the school, and he loves the city. So it's awesome, man.
I don't know how tall he actually is. I mean, I think he's listed at 6 foot, but I think he's probably 5'10", 5'11" in real life. Just to be a guy that size and make it in the NBA and have a decade-plus career, like, you have to be so freaking good at basketball to make it that long being that short.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, like, that was the one thing. Like I said, like, you knew he had the skills, and you knew he can shoot it. And if you just look at his shooting numbers over his career, like, he's a good shooter, but the size limitations on defense were always going to be a problem for him. And you know, to be that size and play for as long as he has, it's not just about, you know, how good of a player he is, but it's also about his character too. He's a great locker room guy. He's a good family man. Every team he's been on, he's gotten positive reviews in terms of like how he contributes to a locker room. So I think he's really well respected too, around the league. And that's why he's been able to last as long as he has. Yeah, man, like him, Chris Paul, and obviously Chris Paul is like a different level of guard, but Chris Paul's not very tall either. He's a guy who's about 6 feet, but DJ is probably even smaller than he is.
DJ is definitely one of those guys that every time I see him, I'm just like, he's still playing. Like, it feels like he was at Texas like 2 decades ago. I think it was, I just looked it up. It was 2006 to 2008. He was there for 2 years. And then like last year in the playoffs, he hits a game winning shot. I think it was against the Raptors. No, I think it was the Raptors
that he hit a game first round against the Raptors, I think.
Absolute killer, man. What was it just like getting to be around Chris Paul this year? That's one guy I'm like kind of jealous that other people have got to cover. I would just love to spend some time and see how Chris Paul ticks.
No, he's you know, going into it, I had a lot of people that I'd run into on the road or I talked to that had been around Chris, whether it was in LA or Houston, and they would tell me all these, they wouldn't necessarily tell me horror stories, but they would kind of like brace, like, how's Chris? And they would ask it in a way like they knew that he was kind of abrasive or that he can be manipulative. And I haven't gotten any of that. I think that Chris has been really good with us. I was expecting a different experience. I think he has an acute understanding of the media. From a standpoint of he's not going to give you anything that he doesn't want to give you. But at the same time, when you ask him questions, he will make a point to tell you a specific story or instance because he knows that's what you're looking for. He doesn't just give you just kind of like junk quotes if he knows what exactly you're trying to get to in a question. So if you're detailed and if you ask him a question that's on point, he'll give you an example. And I love that about him because it helps your writing so much. I've been really appreciative of him off the court, but then he's been a joy to watch too on the court. You know, covering Russell Westbrook for 4 years, you kind of get into a mode of, as incredible of a player he is, there's also kind of an unpredictability. It's almost a predictable unpredictability in late game situations, in situations where the team is struggling and Westbrook feels like he has to put it on his shoulders, and he's just not the shooter that Chris Paul is. So a lot of times you'd have instances where Westbrook would actually shoot his team, not out of a game, but he would shoot the other team back into the game because he's not as efficient as Chris Paul. Chris Paul is so efficient. He's so good at getting to his spots and hitting that mid-range jumper, that elbow jumper, that there's a certain appreciation that comes with how efficient he can be at that size and at that age. You know, this guy's going to be 35 when the restart kicks in at the end of July. He and LeBron are really the only two guys in the league operating at that level. So it's been a pleasure to watch a dude that's like my age, like, continue to kick everybody's ass in the NBA. Like, I couldn't do that. And it's just been cool to watch because he obviously takes the game very seriously and he takes his skill levels really still high.
If you just look at all the crunch time numbers from this season, and I think, you know, just the eye test too, I think Chris Paul was unquestionably the best crunch time performer in the NBA so far. What just makes him, you know, so good in those situations in particular at the end of games?
You know, the shooting, obviously. I think he's somewhere around like the high 40s to 50% from three in clutch time. His free throw shooting is really good. He's crafty in a sense that, you know, when you get close to the bonus, he's going to get that rip move on you and get free throws off of it. So that helps your crunch time numbers too. Typically towards the end of the quarters, he's going to be looking to do that. And I think that some guys just have an understanding of the game and the pace of a game. And when it gets down into those last 5 minutes, you know, how to win in the last 5 minutes of a game, I think he's one of the best, you know, to ever do it in that instance. People give him a lot of shit because of, like, his playoff struggles. And it's warranted because he's had some like real playoff meltdowns, including one against the Thunder. And I think in 2014 when he was playing for the Clippers, But the guy is one of the best point guards we've seen. He's one of the best people I've seen at being able to control a game. And I think people that, you know, followed him from early in his career in New Orleans can remember when he had more explosiveness. He doesn't have that explosiveness anymore, but he still is so crafty and so intelligent that it doesn't matter that he doesn't have the explosiveness he used to, because all he needs is one solid screen from a guy like Steven Adams, and he can get to his spot in the mid-range, and he's going to be able to hit that shot no matter who the defender is. So I think that when you have that in your back pocket and that knowledge late in games, it's almost like you're playing with a handicap, like, or a handicap in your advantage, because you know that you have a shot that you can hit at any juncture of a quarter. You can hit the mid-range, or you can hit a couple of free throws off of a foul. And there aren't many teams in the league that have a guy who can go get an automatic bucket. I mean, I think that's going to be a big thing for them going into Orlando, too.
I think what you're describing, too, is a really prevalent thing. There's some thunder going on. Is really, if you look at the four games against the Pelicans this year that the Thunder won, they swept them. I think that's what you saw in a lot of those games, where the Pelicans were competitive, but then you got down toward the end, especially early in the season, and Chris Paul mainly just, he just ran the offense to death, and they just could not stop it. He outthought them at every juncture. And I'm curious, so that offense completely changed. The Thunder offense completely changed. And I'm curious, how was that transition? Like, going from Russell Westbrook, Paul George, now all of a sudden it's just, it's pure point guard and the same head coach. How did that work?
The biggest shift is you've gone from, you know, top three or four teams in the league in transition points to bottom of the league. That's what happens when you get Chris Paul. Your pace completely changes. And you can look at the same thing for the Rockets, too. Fewer possessions per game with Chris Paul as opposed to Russell Westbrook. But what you're doing in those possessions is more efficient. You're getting better shots because the ball is in the hands of a guy more often who's going to be a better shooter in the mid-range, a better three-point shooter. He's a better shooter at every level than Russell Westbrook. And it's not to say that he's a better player necessarily, but what he does for your offense is he gets more out of less. And I think that that's something that the Thunder's been missing for, you know, basically since Kevin Durant left. Because Kevin Durant was a high-usage guy that was going to get you as much as possible out of the shots he took because he could hit it from every level. When you have Russell Westbrook, you're going to get a guy who's explosive. He's going to be able to score and get you a lot of opportunities because of how fast he is and how he can break down an offense in the transition game and also in the half court just by himself. But you're just not going to be as efficient across the board. And then you add Danilo Gallinari to that, and he's able to space the floor. If you just look at like some of the metrics with him on the floor, their offense is insane when you have Gallinari out there, because he just creates so much space for everybody else. He makes Chris Paul a better finisher. He makes Shai Gilgeous-Alexander a better finisher. He makes Dennis Schroeder a better finisher, because you have to account for him on the backside of a defense because he can shoot the three so well. I think he's shooting close to 40% on like seven or eight attempts a game. So when you combine those factors, you just get for a more efficient offense. And from a Pelican standpoint, they haven't been a great defensive team all year. So when you get into late game situations against veteran players like that, when you got a bunch of young guys who are still trying to learn how to be consistent possession by possession on NBA defense, I mean, you're talking about a Hall of Fame guy who's basically running like a professorial class on how to break down defenses late in games. The Pelicans, they're probably going to break down in those instances, despite all the talent that they have. So the Pelicans shouldn't feel bad. Now, Chris Paul's done that to a lot of teams this year. He's done that to better teams than them. So it's just part of the growing pains, and I think that the Pelicans are going to be better for it.
Yeah, I watched a lot of Gallinari that 2016-17 season with the Nuggets. That was his last season with the Nuggets. I think he's an underrated player. I mean, when he's healthy, that's always the thing with him as health, is he's really freaking good. I mean, he was part of what made that Nuggets offense hum that year. They were, you know, the number one team in offense in the NBA for like the last 4 months of the season. So the Thunder, they have a lot of good players. But you just don't know really what you have a lot of times until you just see it together. You don't know how all the pieces are going to fit. Did the Thunder, I mean, they're 40-24. They're going to challenge for home court advantage, whatever home court advantage is during this restart. Did anybody, like, did they expect to be this good?
I think if you'd ask the players, they'd probably say they did because they didn't want to lose games. But it's hard for anybody to be realistic and say that they thought that this team was going to be together this long. You thought you were going to get – the thing that was going to hinder this team was guys getting dealt. And you thought it would be at least one of these guys, and none of them ended up getting traded for whatever reasons, whether it was the Thunder asking for too much or it was you know, guys just having contracts that just weren't able to be moved, like Chris Paul's. And when you have this many, you know, talented players together that stay relatively healthy, like, good things are probably going to happen. Like, there's a baseline for wins when it comes to a Chris Paul team. I think I looked at this in the preseason when I was getting ready to write about Chris Paul. I think he's been on, even if you count the lockout season, where if you factored in, if they would have played an 82-game season, they would have won 50 games. Chris Paul has basically won 50 or more games for, like, 8 consecutive seasons. He's a guy who, if you have him on your team, you're not going to be bad. There's just no way you're going to be a bad team. So I think that, like, Chris Paul certainly thought that they were going to be competitive. And, you know, a lot of those guys had a lot to play for, too. Like, Gallinari's going to be a free agent. You know, Dennis Schroeder's a guy who's looking for a contract extension or a new contract in 21. Steven Adams is a guy who's going to be a free agent in 21. So you had a lot of guys with a lot of incentive to be good, and you had them led by one of the best leaders we've seen in NBA history, and a lot of people saying that this team wasn't going to be worth a crap. So I think all those factors together have made this team really good in terms of their chemistry and in terms of you know, wanting to kind of prove that they can be a viable playoff team.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Chris Paul, we know that he just has a mammoth amount of money left on his deal. It's in the 40s each of the next two years. I mean, do you see any scenario where he finishes out that contract with the Thunder?
I don't think so. I mean, look, again, it's going to be really hard to move that deal, particularly where cap space is going to be less than it has been, considering that the league's not going to be bringing in as much revenue over the next year, maybe 2 years, because you're not going to have fans in games. So that salary cap number is going to be lower than anticipated, or the luxury tax is going to be lower than anticipated. Those teams that had that cap space might not want to take the risk of bringing in Chris Paul and offloading, you know, some cheaper guys to make the money work. I've always looked at it as a proposition of Paul would want to be traded to a team that's going to contend. The team that's always made the most sense to me just doesn't have the assets because they use it in the Pelicans deal. I thought the Lakers probably made the most sense. You know, he's friends with LeBron. They really need, you know, another ball handler to take some of that pressure off of LeBron as he gets a little older. He's good defensively. He can shoot. LeBron needs shooters around him. And then Chris's family's in L.A. So that always made the most sense to me. But the Pelicans deal with the Lakers giving up as many assets as they have, I just don't think that's going to be possible over the next year or so. And that's when you turn your attention to teams like Miami, Milwaukee. You know, the Knicks have been rumored because of the Leon Rose connection, with Leon Rose kind of taking over their basketball operations and him being Chris Paul's former agent at CAA. It's really just difficult to find fits. But I think it is doable, maybe once they get into the last year of his deal. Maybe even this summer. They're going to try again. I think they're going to listen. There's no reason why they shouldn't, because they're not a team that's going to be competing for a championship even with Chris Paul. So if they somehow find a suitor or maybe incorporate a third team to where they can make it a three-team deal, to where they can make the money work and get what they want while every other team gets what they want, then I think it's something they need to look at again this summer for sure.
And that contract, the final year of that contract, I want to say it pays, what, $44 million? Something.
I think it's 44, yeah. Player option for $44 million. I mean, you'd imagine he'd pick that up, especially considering
yeah, you think.
He's going to be, you know, I think 36 going into that the last year of that deal. And then, you know, with the salary cap just being as uncertain as it's going to be, you know, that's a lot to take on. But if a team is looking at it from a standpoint of, you know, we're trying to add that final guy, or we're trying to change our culture. I think that's what the Knicks rumors were about. They're just trying to completely change their culture. You know, maybe that's something that the Thunder can get done. And, you know, that they might have to eat some of that on that deal. They're not going to get the return they got from the first time around where they get two first-round picks. But, frankly, when you get two first-round picks for Chris Paul in the initial deal, you get two first-round picks and Chris Paul for Russell Westbrook, you can probably look at your future deal as, okay, we probably made out better than we should have the first time around. Maybe we can afford to kind of, you know, eat it on this one and take a step back in terms of what we get back, get some expirings, something like that, where maybe we don't get that perfect second rounder we want that's unprotected or something like that, because they just did so well the first time getting two first round picks from the Rockets. Nobody could have ever imagined that that would happen.
This is going back to the Hornets days a little bit, but did you guys see on the Knuckleheads podcast this week, Chris Paul said that when he took his visit to New Orleans, Byron Scott took him out to a TGI Fridays?
I didn't see that, and shame on Byron Scott. Like,
Byron Scott took him to a TGI Fridays in New Orleans.
Like, I'm not like the guru of New Orleans food or anything. Like, I grew up outside of New Orleans in La Place, so like I don't know a ton of. I could like name just names of stuff like Commander's Palace or Galatoire's or all kinds of stuff that's like famous. I don't know like what to recommend to people, but I can tell you this: you could probably take Chris Paul to like any gas station along Airline Highway, and it'll probably have better food than TGI Fridays. Like, people are just making gumbo and like jambalaya out of gas stations that's better than TGI Fridays, like crispy chicken fingers or whatever, man. It's just, maybe that's why.
Taking a Magnolia discount, he'll be happy.
Maybe that's why Chris Paul left New Orleans. Maybe he was like, you know what? I'm still salty about the time that Byron Scott took me to TGI Fridays when I live in the seafood capital of the world. Like, maybe that's what I'm a little bit upset about. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, in any city, it's like insulting. In New Orleans, it's like an affront to.
It's not right.
The food.
I tell you this, Alvin Gentry wouldn't have done that. Alvin Gentry would have did it.
Oh,
right.
Oh no, Alvin knows the spots for sure. And to your point that there are just all these incredible holes in the walls attached to gas stations. One of my favorite places to eat, probably my favorite place to eat here, is Bon Me Boys. It's attached to a Texaco. On the way to the Pelicans practice facility, I get this shrimp banh mi sandwich. I mean, there's just a million places like that. You're never going to go hungry. But that was pretty insulting. I mean, you could just tell in Chris Paul's voice, he's like, man, I can't believe this dude did this to me. And he didn't really want to work out here. It was kind of a situation where, like, look, we're going to draft you even if you don't work out here, so come visit. And he did it, and then TGI Fridays.
Well, you know what? It was a smart move because, you know, Chris Paul set up a lot of good things for them. If they don't get Chris Paul, they don't get AD, they don't get Zion. So it's all dominoes, man. And that's why you take the best guy, man. Like, you don't worry about trying to fit positions and stuff like that. Chris Paul was the best guy. And, you know, the Pelicans or the Hornets at the time did the right thing because he's kind of like the godfather of basketball for them, or one of those guys that would probably be on their Mount Rushmore, you know, if you count like AD, guys like Baron Davis, David West, stuff like that. So
easily.
Yeah, for sure.
So I have a Chris Paul anecdote that I still think is like one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. And it's secondhand. And I want to tell it to you and see if this sounds like the Chris Paul you know. So this was back when he was in college at Wake Forest. I want to say it was 2006. This was back when Wake Forest was, you know, perennially a power. They had Tim Duncan a few years before that, and they had Jeff Teague a few after that. And they faced West Virginia in the NCAA tournament that year. Now, you, if you remember that team, it was the one with Kevin Pitsnoggle.
Oh, yeah.
And Mike Gansey, and John Beilein was the coach. And I want to say Joe Alexander was on that team, too, but he was a bench player. He formed a future lottery pick that was bad.
That was a terrible pick.
So this story was told to me by he's now a professor at Longwood University, which is located in Farmville, Virginia, which is a real place. I looked it up. And he covered that game, and he said that he went into the locker room after Wake Forest lost. I want to say it was overtime. They lost to West Virginia, which is a huge underdog. He said he walked in, he saw Chris Paul on the bench, had a towel over his head. He was, like, looking down, and he was like, oh, he must be – he's so distraught. And he was, and he went over, and what Chris Paul said was, can't believe I lost to Mike f***ing Gansey.
Oh, man.
That sounds like Chris Paul.
Sounds about right. I mean, he knows he's good, man. It's like – he knows he's good, and he understands the game so well, and he knows his capabilities and the other team's capabilities so well that it's like he can say stuff like that because he knows when he's up against a hooper and when he's up against a guy that he should dominate. And no offense to Mike Gansey, he was a good college player, but
he wore huge T-shirts under.
Yeah, but he wasn't Chris Paul. And look, man, it's not like Chris Paul had a ton of – he didn't have a ton of help on those Wake Forest teams. Like, he was – this wasn't the, the Al-Farouq Aminu Wake Forest teams that had a little bit more talent a few years later. Chris Paul was the show, man. So he shouldn't feel that bad, but Chris Paul's a competitor, man. He takes all that stuff a little personally, I think, when he loses those individual battles like that.
So, Eric, your first year in the Thunder beat was 2016-17, right?
15-16, the Kevin Durant final season.
Okay, so you get thrown onto the beat during, a year where everybody's speculating that Kevin Durant might leave. I mean, what was it just like tackling a beat during, a pretty stressful year?
Well, I was fortunate that I had a lot of really good writers and editors around me to kind of guide me. A lot of the people that were around me are writing for The Athletic now. Anthony Slater writes about the Warriors. He was kind of instrumental in helping me. Darnell Mayberry, who Christian, he writes for the Bulls now for The Athletic, and he was my editor, and he was a big time help because he had covered the Thunder for so long. So for me, I was nervous a lot because I had never done that before at that level. I covered everything, but I'd never been one of those guys that was in the middle of a team that was that important. So I was pretty nervous every time I went to the arena. I used to joke around years down the line and say, I wish that I still felt that nervous because I was nervous to the point to where I couldn't eat when I got to the arena. Because I didn't want to be all tired and I didn't want to be bogged down. And I lost a shit ton of weight. If I wanted to get on a diet, I wish I kind of felt that way so I could get on a diet and lose 20 or 30 pounds, man. Cause I could go back and look at these videos I was in on the Oklahoman website. And I'm like, man, I was skinny. I must've been just not eating all the time. Cause I was nervous. So it was a fun year. I wish I could go back and do it again because I wish I could do it with the set of eyes and the understanding that I have now, because I was just trying to keep up back then. But I wish I would have paid attention the way I do now and understood the game better, because Kevin Durant's incredible, man. And Russell Westbrook is too. And I had the pleasure of covering Russell Westbrook for, I guess, 4 seasons, but only having Kevin Durant one, he's one of the best basketball players I've ever had a chance to watch in person, and it was a privilege, and I wish I could have done it more, because you take for granted how a person of his size can be as fluid and efficient as he is. There will be times where I think in that season the Thunder was kind of just coasting. I think they were to the point in their careers where they understood what they needed to do to win games, and that meant sometimes not putting out as much effort as they probably needed to kind of save themselves for the playoffs or big matchups. And there would be times that the Thunder was playing like crap, and Durant would just say, all right, let's go. And there'd be 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter, and he'd score 12 straight points. He'd just be like, all right, let's go. Just start hitting jumpers with people in his face. Andrew Wiggins would be guarding him as hard as he could, and he'd just hit a jumper over him. And Durant would just be like, no big deal. 24-footer in Andrew Wiggins' face, over length, whatever. It'd be nice to be able to witness that again, because you don't get many chances to watch guys that good.
I just read that book by Ethan Sherwood Strauss, Victory Machine, and it kind of, you know, it talks about KD's time with the Warriors, and it paints a portrait of a guy who's just kind of unhappy despite a lot of success. You know, you covered KD at a very different time in his life. What was just the general mood that season for him?
He was chill. In retrospect, I think he handled it really well, because every city that he went to, he got the same same questions that editors would require people to ask when a guy like that comes to your town. And he handled it professionally, I thought. You know, this was a guy who I think at many junctures in his career has cared a lot about what people think about him and the moves he makes and how he's portrayed. And there were times where he really showed that to us, that he had a deep, deep care for what people thought of him. And I imagine that it's really difficult to go through that when you've spent 8 years somewhere, but then you understand that it's time for you to make a new move in your life and to seek something different. And I think that that was the most important part for him, was he needed a change of scenery. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you think about how old he was when he made that move, when somebody's 26 or 27 years old, I think a lot of us get that way. We get to a point to where we're like, you know, I've been here for a certain amount of time. I want to go do some stuff before it gets too late. And I think that was kind of where he was at in his career. He'd had a lot of individual accomplishments. He lived in a nice enough city, but he gets to go live on the coast, make a shit ton of money, and play with really highly skilled basketball players. That's not an opportunity that comes along very often. But I thought he handled it really well. And I think that people, even at the time when like the letter came out and people didn't appreciate the way that he left, he didn't have to write a letter at all. He could have just bounced without any kind of letter.
He could have worn a shirt that said, "That's all, folks," like Anthony Davis did.
Yeah. Christ almighty. But I think in a way, like Kev, like kind of opened it up for a lot of guys to do that. And LeBron was obviously the guy that started that. But Kev's kind of in that line where he opened it up for guys, you know, to be okay with making that decision. And I thought he handled it well. And like, I don't think that he necessarily owes anybody anything here, because he gave 8 years of his career and he played really hard. He came up short. He probably should have been better in some clutch moments, but you could say that about a lot of guys in the NBA. Sometimes it just takes time and maturity and getting with the right mix of players. Now, he had to get with two of the best shooters of all time, one of the best defensive players of all time, to win the title. But look, a lot of guys have had to get with some really good guys to win championships too. So he was great. He was great to be around. He's a good dude, man. He really is.
I'm so curious to see how this run with the Nets go, because look, if you just look at the guys, the history of guys who've had Achilles injuries, it's not pretty. They're just, you know, across the board, they're just not who they were. But on the other hand, I think that Kevin Durant is so unique that if there's anybody whose game is suited to, you know, still being a really good player after this injury, it's him.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is just like coexisting with Kyrie Irving. Like, they might be like buds or whatever, but just from a basketball standpoint, like how that's going to work, because it just seems that Kyrie, other than playing with LeBron, which wore on Kyrie itself, like he's kind of like hijacked teams to the point to where it hasn't been productive, particularly with the Celtics. So I just wonder how that is going to work when Kevin's coming off of an injury. What if he starts playing really well and he's the alpha? How's Kyrie going to respond? I don't think Kevin's going to have a problem deferring to Kyrie, because I think Kevin's kind of got a deferential kind of temperament to begin with, even though he's one of the most alpha in terms of skills we've ever seen. But that's an interesting experiment, man. And you know, if, even if Kevin loses some athleticism, he's still going to be a knockdown shooter, I would think. So, you know, what version we get of him is going to be really interesting to see, dude. I'm really intrigued to see how that works.
So here's one thing that I always get struck with when I look at the Thunder, which is they may be the best drafting team in the NBA over the last two decades. And I obviously include the Supersonics in that, which is technically the team that drafted Kevin Durant. But, you know, you go back to guys they have drafted. Kevin Durant, obviously. Serge Ibaka, Russell Westbrook. Those were three consecutive first-round picks. James Harden in 2009, the next year. Eric Bledsoe. Reggie Jackson. Steven Adams. And then Terrence Ferguson now. Did they draft Shea? I don't know if they drafted Shea Gilgeous.
They drafted the Clippers. They essentially, I mean, if you count like a team drafting a guy and then trading it to you, I mean, you could almost count Domantas Sabonis too, because he was part of the Ibaka package. But anyway, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I mean, is that, you know, when you look at a team like the Pelicans, who basically, other than Anthony Davis and, you know, Zion, the two number one overall picks, which were pretty much, you know, you know who you're going to take, they haven't really. They've had a really difficult draft history, whereas the Thunder, they've were able to create a team that had Russell Westbrook, James Harden, Serge Ibaka, and Kevin Durant on it. They didn't win, but they made it to the finals. They didn't win, but they, you know, what is it? You know, obviously you've only been covering them for the last few years, but what is it like watching a team where it's like you expect to get a player like that in the draft?
Well, I mean, since I've covered the team, I haven't really expected that. Because I think they've. You know, as time has gone on, they've gotten farther back in the first round, which makes it more difficult to hit on those guys. Like, hitting on Serge Ibaka and Reggie Jackson is like a miracle. That's as much of a miracle as hitting on Russell Westbrook and James Harden in the top five, to me. Because a guy like Serge Ibaka at 21, where they got him, in the same draft as getting Russell Westbrook, and then Serge Ibaka becoming the player he has, where at one point, he was like probably the most versatile guy in the league in terms of being able to stretch, protect the rim, and guard five positions when you're switching on defense. Like, that just doesn't happen very often in the history of the NBA. Serge Ibaka can do almost anything you ask him to do on a basketball court. You don't get those kind of guys at 21. So it's a credit to the Thunder's like development, their talent evaluation. And even a guy like Reggie Jackson, who like gets a lot of crap because of the way that he left Oklahoma City, he's a NBA point guard. Like he's a solid NBA point guard. He's a guy who's like won them games. So being in Oklahoma the entire time that the Thunder's existed, I think has been really cool because you've gotten to see this team grow from nothing. I remember when I worked at this paper in Ardmore, and Christian is probably familiar with Ardmore, which is kind of in southern Oklahoma. It was a two-man team working in Ardmore, and we had this small paper. And I was there in 2008 when the Thunder was terrible. I mean, they were like 3-20-something at one point, and they fired P.J. Carlissimo after like 13 games. And every night we'd be building the paper, and we would say, hey, man, the Thunder played tonight. Where do we want to put the Thunder? And we'd be like, oh, just put them on page 3 or some shit. Like, and it's crazy to even think that the Thunder could be some page 3 team now. Like, but within like a year, they went from the back of our sports section to the front page every night because they went from 23 wins to 50. And then maintained it all because, you know, they drafted really well and these guys were developed and they were hungry. So the Thunder are kind of like the prototype for a lot of NBA teams now. You know, you draft, you develop. You go through a year or two of growing pains. I think you're seeing that in Memphis for sure. I think the Pelicans have a real chance to be that with Zion now. And, you know, a lot of these young guys, they probably grew up looking at a team like the Thunder like, yo, like, those are the guys we want to be like. We want to be like Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden. Like, years ago, I think Philly, like Embiid and Simmons were talking about, we don't want to be like the way that Durant and Westbrook and Harden got broken up. Like, we don't want it to be like that. But to even have like an ounce of the success those guys had in a 5 or 6 year span would be a success for any team.
Yeah. You know, you're right that Zion is trying to make the Pelicans and has a pretty good shot of making them, you know, kind of a front page story every night and a consistent draw. I've lived in and worked in Texas, Oklahoma, Denver, and now here. And I think this is the most football obsessed region I've ever lived in out of all those places. And maybe it's because I'm coming into this, you know, at a time when the Saints are really good and LSU just won a national championship. I'm sure that has a lot to do with it, but I didn't realize coming into Louisiana just how football crazy this place is.
Yeah, LSU is basically like another pro team. So there's just not enough. There typically doesn't exist enough bandwidth with the people who care about sports to care about three things. It's usually Saints and LSU. And then there's kind of a niche group of people who care about everything else. And I would even say something like LSU baseball ranks ahead of the Pelicans.
You'd be right, yeah.
Pre-Zion. If Zion gets this thing cranking, like, people are going to care. Because people cared about, you know, the Chris Paul Hornets. But you got to be really good. And I think that the Pelicans have a good chance to be like those teams because – not just because Zion is a special player, but because he has good young players around him. He's not going to have to be a dude scoring 30 points a game every night because Brandon Ingram's an all-star. You know, Lonzo Ball is like a competent defender who is a great team player who shares the ball. Josh Hart is a solid NBA rotation player who can hit a three. Like, you got a bunch of dudes who are pretty good dudes around the same age who are going to be able to take some of that weight off of Zion. So I think that they have an opportunity to kind of be in that kind of grouping. And it helps that you got a guy like Zion who's so charismatic, who's so awesome. And frankly, like, with the way that the Saints are going, I don't know how much longer this thing's gonna last, man, because y'all can try and convince me that Taysom Hill's the next Drew Brees, but I've been telling people I hope everybody on your podcast hears this. Taysom Hill is not good. All right. I'm going to just say it. And you can put it out there. I don't care, man. Teddy Bridgewater was the dude. There was a reason that Teddy was starting over that guy when Drew Brees went out. Okay. Because they don't trust him. He's not a good downfield thrower. He hasn't had to go through progressions for an entire game. Teddy's done all that stuff, and he doesn't turn the ball over. So you're basically starting to H-back at quarterback that you believe in, who's not even that good of a quarterback. I think this Saints thing is going to fall off severely if they don't get somebody that's better than Taysom Hill. Like, I'm not gonna get all excited about Jameis or whatever, but, like, I feel more secure with Jameis coming into a game and having to lead a 2-minute drill than Taysom Hill. That's all I'm saying. Like, I'm sorry, man. I got on a rant. I'm sorry. I'm going to chill out.
You heard it here first. Taysom Hill, bad.
He's not good. He's just not that good. I'm sorry.
Like, I would argue Taysom Hill is really good at being Taysom Hill.
Yeah.
Taysom Hill is not like a pocket passer.
His gimmick stuff is cool. And, like, everybody got excited because he was like the most effective weapon against the Minnesota Vikings. Like, play that game 9 times out of 10, and Drew Brees isn't going to play that poorly, and Taysom Hill's not going to play that good. That was a one game sample of Taysom Hill being this really effective thing that Minnesota couldn't account for. Like, that doesn't play out to 16 games. That's not how this shit works, man. Like, I'm sorry.
I think we've touched a nerve. We didn't even bring up Taysom Hill. You brought it up. You really wanted to talk about this.
In here, okay? I grew up watching, like, the Saints are my team, and it just makes me – it just annoys the hell out of me, man. It's like, all right. See, this is what Christian's talking about, the football passion, man. Like, we weren't even talking about football. This isn't even a football podcast, and we start talking about this stuff, man. It's, like, ridiculous. So, anyway.
Well, Eric, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk to our sports editor and see if we can get you a guest op-ed just so you can tee off on Taysom Hill, okay? We'll give you like 1,000 words. Is that enough?
I don't want to bang on the dude too hard. Like, I just want fans to calm down. Like, now, and frankly, I want the Saints to calm down too, because I think they're way too excited about Taysom Hill. And it's to me, it's kind of like a smokescreen. Like, maybe they're trying to get somebody to, like, trade for him and they get, like, picks or something. I don't get it, because if they really thought that much of him, they just would have played him last year. Like, they obviously don't think he's that good, or they're trying to make other people believe he's good. We spent way too much time on this, man. I'm sorry.
All right, man.
I'm always down to talk Saints. I have one question that I do want to ask beforehand, because it concerns one of the people that fascinates me most in the NBA, which is Steven Adams, yeah. Who I just learned played a year for the Wellington Saints before going to Pittsburgh, where I first encountered him, because I grew up in Connecticut. I'm a UConn fan. And those UConn-Pittsburgh battles from back in the day were always just, they were crazy. Anyway, the half court shot put three before halftime against the Pelicans, if you recall this.
Steven Adams. And wow! The one-hander from half court.
Wow. I was going to say, that's Steven the second Adams. Percentage buster that they've given him. Wow.
The big man slings it up and slings it in. So obviously Chris Paul knew what he was doing. He held the follow through.
Yeah.
it wasn't even a shot. It was quite literally a shot put.
Yeah.
And I assume you were there for that. And Christian, I can't remember if you were there.
I don't think I was there for that one.
So I'm just curious, did he talk about that after the game? Because it struck me that his sister is like an Olympic shot putter.
Yeah.
And I have been wondering since if that played a role in his decision to just literally.
Well, it's funny because I think there's a clip out there, you could find it, that a few games before that at a Thunder home game, he tried one and it came up short, or he missed pretty poorly. And you could see Chris Paul as they're walking off the court. Chris Paul is showing Steven Adams. He's like, hey, man, you got to float that thing. And he's showing him the motion. So, like, Chris Paul told him what to do. And then Steven Adams comes out the next game and just lets that thing go, and it's perfect. Like, so once again, Chris Paul, man, that's why he's on my MVP ballot, because Steven Adams is hitting, like, three-quarter court shots and shit. Chris Paul has made Steven Adams a better player. It's clear. It's obvious. Like,
one of my favorite moments from this Pelican season, this is the last thing before we let you go, was when Zion moved Steven Adams out of the way. Like, Zion got an offensive rebound, and then he barreled into Steven Adams. And Steven Adams, just a tree of a human being, like, just goes back 6 feet.
Yeah. There have been so many instances this year where I've been like, I've never seen anybody do that on a basketball court. From Zion, and you could tell when Zion played the Pelicans the Thunder for the first time, and I think he might have had 27 or 28, something like that. He went off. You could tell that Steven Adams was like, whoa, like, because usually he's not really, even when a guy's like more athletic than him, you don't really see him kind of like react to it, but I think Steven Adams was even kind of taken aback by, like, how explosive and big that dude was. A lot of teams were. I count me among the skeptics, the Zion skeptics, man. Like, I thought he would round out into being a really good player. I didn't know he would be this good this fast. I love seeing guys from college who you had questions about come into the league and be better, because the league is better suited for what they do. And I think that Zion is going to be a guy who is really going to flourish, because he can do more than he was being asked to do at Duke. And he's going to get more space to do it in. You know, he's a great passer. He's a really good passer. I did not know he was that good of a passer. Like, his second jump, obviously outstanding. Once he works on his free throws and stuff, and he gets just more repetitions, and he doesn't have to worry about going to class and shit, like, he's going to be good at that. He'll be fine. But more than anything, I think that people just get excited about him. And I think that there are only a handful of guys in the league that can just galvanize a team by, like, just being out there. And you could tell that team feeds off of his energy. I think I remember, was it the game against the Spurs he hit all those threes?
That was his first game. Yeah.
It was the Spurs. Well, I was watching that game with some buddies of mine in a bar, And, you know, it started off with, like, a bunch of the obligatory, like, oh, Zion's fat jokes or whatever. And everybody's like, oh, this guy's out of shape. I was like, man, he needs to lose some weight because, like, he was struggling. But once he started hitting shots, I'm telling you, the whole bar was just like, every time the Spurs missed a shot and he gets the ball, everybody was just like, shoot it! Shoot the ball! We were just like, just shoot that hoe. I don't care. Just shoot it. And, like, the bar was exploding. So I can't even, like, and this is in Oklahoma City. So I can't imagine what it's like being an actual fan of that team and being in New Orleans and watching that guy, like, galvanize your team and your players that way. Like, he changes the entire confidence of a team when he's on the floor. And there just aren't that many guys that do that.
Yeah, that was the most fun night of watching basketball I've ever had was that night in the blender. I mean, I guess maybe the most fun quarter because the first three quarters were not that fun, but it was incredible.
Yeah. No, that fourth quarter was awesome.
It felt like a playoff game. Like, it was that intense.
Yeah, and it was like, if they would have – now, look, they needed him to hit those shots to even be close at the end, but he's on the pitch count, basically, and then they got to take him out, and you're like, dude, if they would have managed his minutes differently and, like, had him at – like, it, but it all worked the way it was – like – they would have won the game if he was in at the end. They'd have won. Like, he'd have found a way to make a play. But you're just like, man, don't – you're sitting there thinking, like, they're going to pull him. They're going to pull him because they said they were going to. But then you're like, just leave him – shit. Just leave him out there. But that's how exciting that guy is, man. That's how much he impacts winning. Like, and I'm excited to see what kind of shape he's in. You know, I guess everybody's been saying he's in good shape. So we'll see.
Yeah, the Pelicans released some B-roll footage of guys in the workout facility, and he looks pretty good, you guys.
So. I'm all for it, man. And look, with that schedule they've got, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to at least make the 8-9 play-in situation, and that's just the league's dream at this point.
Okay, so Eric Horn in on the Pelicans, not so much on Taysom Hill.
No, I'm out on him. I'm in on Zion. You can put Zion at quarterback, and I'd feel more comfortable at this point, to be honest with you. I'm not joking, by the way.
I would pay to see Zion at quarterback.
Run Wildcat. Run Wildcat with Zion. See what happens.
Who's tackling that guy?
Nobody.
They'd run. That's what they would do. All right, Eric. Well, hey, man, I really appreciate you hopping on. People can find your work on The Athletic. Where are you on Twitter?
It's Eric with a K and then the letter K and then Horne. That's my Twitter handle. I'm there. I'm talking about Thunder stuff. Maybe I'll throw out some Taysom Hill stuff now. Who knows? But check out my work at theathletic.com as well. Free 30-day subscription right now, so you can't lose.
All right, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.